Welcome to Tips from the Server Room. This podcast is designed for all you systems admins, network specialists, or the guys and gals out there in the office who handles it all. Sit back, relax, grab a beverage, and enjoy Tips from the Server Room. Hey, welcome back, my friends, once again to Tips from the Server Room. This is episode number 82 for March the 3rd, 2015. I'm your host, Jack, and as always, I'm going to help guide you through all those magical worlds of servers, connectivity, network switches, routers, firewalls, active directories, DNS, DHCP, and all things that make up our job as network administrators, technology enthusiasts, or the guys and girls out there, the accidental techies is who I'm talking about. In the office, you know, the one that people call upon and say, hey, Sally, can you help me with this Microsoft document? Yep, we're talking about all you folks out there. You know, the accidental techies also. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Check out all the great tech podcasts at techpodcast.com. Also, we are now syndicated, remember, across Stitcher.com. That's S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.com, where you can pick up this show and many other podcasts. Yeah, okay, tech folks, believe me, there's a lot of podcasts out there that you're not listening to because they're not tech-related. And there's a lot of shows out there covering about every single topic you can think of under the sun. You can download their app today on your smartphone. And that is either Android or iOS. I don't know if they have a Windows platform or not. Hopefully they do. But that's Stitcher.com. Check them out. I'm sure you'll be glad that you did. And check us out, folks. Go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com where you can comment on these shows. I want to thank everybody out there as a preface to the show for using my Amazon link. This month was the first month I ever received a big, staggering bonus check from Amazon. Now, if you think that's catchy, well, let me tell you, it was about $47, but you know what? It's huge because it's showing that you are using my Amazon link, and that's huge. I want you to continue to do so. Every $47 helps, my friends. Check that out at tipsfromserverroom.com. You can also comment on these shows, and I hope you do comment, and leave me a voice message. I do have two voicemails coming up in the next two shows. Tonight's show was already kind of laid out. The show notes was already done. So we're going to go with tonight's show the way it is. But I do have two voicemails, and I do appreciate the two folks that called in. So you will be hearing your calls on the show within the next two shows. That number is 724-701-0550. Once again, 724-701-0550. And folks, don't worry. Don't say, man, I'm going to call and Jack's going to pick up and I'm going to sound dumb. No, don't worry about that. It's a voicemail line. Call in. If you mess up, hang up and call back in and do it again. You know, there's no negativity for error. There's no badgering you because you made a mistake. I'll just delete that phone call and I'll go to the next call. So it's not a big deal. Call in and leave me your little voicemail. Your questions always go a long way on a podcast. If you have any questions or future ideas for shows, I would like to hear from you. Really, I would like to hear from you. You can email those to jackstechcorner@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter and as @technoman, T-E-C-H-N-O-M-A-N. Many of you are following me on there. And I don't badger you with Twitter spam. I hate when you follow somebody on Twitter, next thing you know, every other tweet is from them. I don't do that. I try to only tweet when there's something important to say. If there's nothing important to say, I don't bother you. That's the way I like to keep it. So, folks, we're going to start off this week, first of all, by talking about something that came into my news feed because I have a couple Google alerts set up. And if you've never set up a Google alert, if you have Gmail, you're already halfway there. Go in. You can set up alerts on your email if something comes across the internet based on a certain standard. So I have Windows Server. And if anything about Windows Server comes across the internet per day, I get an email and it gives me all these different links for all this different stuff talked about Windows Server. And you can do it for any subject. It's really cool. Well, I had a link came to me today, or yesterday, I think it was, And it said Windows Server 10 has been leaked this week. So Windows Server 10, the ISO, image, the full install has been leaked this week. Now, granted, it's in a beta version, so it's nothing that you're going to put on your production servers. And, you know, I'm sure it's very, very buggy. And when these things happen, when this stuff happens, it often makes me wonder, and I wonder this a lot, and I've told my my staff this, I've told my assistant this, I wonder a lot of times if it's not Microsoft leaking this stuff. Because, you know, it would go a long way if they would leak it, because people would start seeing it. Then, you know, they do a bunch of hype over, oh, our software got leaked out there. But in reality, it didn't get leaked at all. You know, maybe they actually put it out there on the torrent sites. Who knows how that gets out there? Let's talk about upgrades for a few minutes, since I brought this subject up about Windows 10 being leaked. And just kick this around in your head a little bit as you're driving your car this morning or as you're listening to me in your office. And think how many of you out there are still running Windows Server 2003. I know we still have, believe it or not, two instances running of Windows Server 2003, and we are working with the companies now to migrate those over to 2012. We have the virtual machines, the virtual servers are set, ready to go, but we need the software vendor to help us migrate their software over to these particular servers so we can down our 2003 servers. And that does happen, you know, from time to time. But where I'm getting at is, and I know some folks, you know, I was interviewed by, I got to interview somebody at Microsoft about migrating a Windows 2003 server. Some shows back, you might want to go back and listen to that one. That was a really good interview. So I know people at Microsoft may pick up this show. Some people there may be listening. So hear my pleas. Now, I'm going to plead with you a little bit without getting on a soapbox. And many of you listening to the show know that I've been doing technology for a lot of years. I mean, I started with Windows NT 3.5 on a server. So I've been doing this for a long time. And many of you out there from the emails I get have been doing this even longer than that. But the aspect that I'm looking at here tonight with this particular talk is you can't keep upgrading these servers at such a rapid pace that you're upgrading these servers. I mean, the software. You know, we can do security patches. We can do version, let's say, server 2012's out now, 2012. We can do like 2012.1, 2012.5. For security enhancements and stuff, we understand that as a group of people. But to keep bringing these servers out so quickly, and it started with pretty much with Windows Server 2000, you know, so you went from 2000, then you went to 2003, then you went to from 2003 to where do we go next? To 2008. From 2008, we're on 2012. So there has been like 2 or 3 years in between those server versions. But 2012 has not been around that long. And now we have Windows Server 10 leaked. And I imagine the full version of 10 is not going to come out for at least probably 2 more years, I would hope, because Microsoft, we as network administrators can't upgrade that rapidly. Not only that, the software vendors that we use, a lot of the software vendors could be a very old group of vendors. I know one of our software companies, there is about 6 guys working for them. And, you know, they're just now getting their software ready to roll with 2012 to make sure it's really, really ramped up and ready to go. So that's some thoughts I have with that. Now, my partner had a thought with this. My partner or my colleague at work says, Jack, well, if they're giving away Windows 10, right, when it comes out, for free for 1 year, are they going to do that with Windows Server 10? I said, well, absolutely. They would have to. They're setting a precedence now where they're giving away software for 1 year. They're going to have to give us Windows Server 10, especially if we're running Windows Server 2012, and it's a big, rapid upgrade. And the only reason I can think they would do this is, one, at this point, to keep all their versions the same numbering schemes now. I think that would be important. The second reason they may do this with the Windows Server 10 is very simply to be able to put all the new enhancements in there for Windows 10 so you can control it. Okay, so moving on and moving up to tonight's topic or of discussion, is virtual server licensing concerns. Now, in some past shows, we talked about virtualization, virtualizing your servers. I'm a big fan of this because I believe that a lot of your servers in your racks are underutilized. And if you try to argue that point with me, email me and call my voice line and say, Jack, there's no way our servers are underutilized. They are used to the max. We have a server, you know, it's dual Xeon processors. It's 16 gigs of RAM. And, you know, we have 20 users using it all day long. Now, let me tell you, folks, it's underutilized, okay? When I started looking at virtualization some years ago, I started to do a lot of calculating and a lot of graphs, a lot of charts, because I wanted to wrap my own mind around to say, look, if I do virtualize my servers, am I saving anything? I mean, we use ESXi, which we're looking at upgrading this year to the full vSphere, I believe it's called now, software from VMware. So we're going to be running the full version. There's a lot of bells and whistles and benefits to that I want to use. But if you have a small environment, you have one server that you want to virtualize, then use ESXi because it's free. It's rock solid. We haven't had any trouble with it so far. We've been using it now for quite a number of years, quite a bit of versions we went through to use this software. And we like it to the point where it's free, but now we have two physical servers. Right now we have three physical servers virtualized with virtual machines on them with ESXi running. So our goal here is to get all those servers with the full version on there, because we're looking at now when you have multiple physical servers, as I said before when we had this talk, is the actual machine, if something happens to the physical box, can move itself to another physical box and keep running. So your uptime is going to be greatly improved over any downtime, if you ever have downtime. Or if you have to take that machine down for maintenance, you can move it physically on your own. You can manually move it and still have that machine running. But there's some concerns that I had with that. And the concerns we were looking at was virtual server licensing concerns. And this topic kind of goes into a couple of different aspects here, and I'm going to throw some of my own into it. But one aspect of server virtualization that is sometimes overlooked is licensing. Virtualization can complicate software licensing, so it is important for the administrator to exercise due diligence in making sure that your organization has purchased the required licenses. Now, there are a couple of different issues that can make licensing difficult in a virtual environment. One such issue is that the organization may have to purchase several different licensing types in order to remain compliant. Some of the required licensing types are hypervisor license, if you're using Microsoft, management server licenses, managed server licenses, the guest OS server licenses. A lot of people miss that. The guest OS client access licenses, which we talked about CALS a while back. Application licenses and application client access licenses. Now, I'm not going to take tonight, and I'm not going to take your drive to work and bore you to death with talking about each one of those. So I'm just going to break down some of that. Here's the guest operating system. Now, just because you have one version of Microsoft Server 2012 and you're only using one physical server, that doesn't really qualify you or mean that you can install four virtual machines on that one physical server with that one physical media with one licensing. What you need to do is buy four separate copies of Microsoft Server 2012 or 2008 R2 or whatever you're going to run, and have multiple licenses for each instance of that server. A lot of people miss that. They think, well, and I get a lot of emails that says, Jack, look, I only have one physical box. I got one media. Can I load 12 virtual machines? No, you can't. You would need 12 physical licenses for those 12 different machines, because Microsoft doesn't care how you operate their server. They don't care if it's virtualized or if it's on a physical box. The main thing is you have to license each instance you have running. That's the main thing. Now, we talk about the hypervisor licenses or the VMware licenses you need. Remember, ESXi, I told you, is absolutely free. You put it on and forget about it. It just simply works. I do understand Microsoft does have a licensing compliance with their hypervisor or hypervisor licensing or hyper whatever they want to call it. Anyway, their virtual machine software that Microsoft sells. You know, and it's nice. I know a couple places running it, and I've never seen it in use, so I really can't tell you much about it, but I can't tell you it's out there, and I do know you have to license it. If you're using the full version of VMware, we've been just going through the pricing scheme now to set up our servers this summer with it, and it is based on processor. So if you have a server with four processors, it's going to be four different licenses you're going to need for that server. You license it by the processor socket. But be careful with that, because if a socket has no processor in it, don't buy a license because it's an empty socket. You're not paying for an empty socket. You're paying for the processor. At one point in talking at work and figuring out some of our budgeting stuff, we looked at this and said, wait, I originally thought it was per core. We started looking at our cores and how many cores we have. Well, servers today can have 2 4-core processors or 2 8-core processors. You'd be paying for 16 core. That would be a ton of money. So luckily it's based on the processor, the socket and the chip that's in it. Now, application licenses, a lot of people don't understand this either. And I know it's very easy to get away with this, folks. It's extremely easy to fly under the radar. If you're not a big business, Microsoft's probably not going to come knocking at your door. But, you know, anytime you're working with proprietary software, and we know Microsoft Office is a proprietary program. They sell it. You have to buy it. We did a job for a client about maybe 6 months ago, and the client couldn't get their head wrapped around it. They said, no, wait, Jack, if I buy one copy of Microsoft Office and the office owns all these computers, can't we put this one copy in all these computers? I said, yeah, you can, but I think in 30 days it's going to quit working on, you know, 8 of the 9 machines because they have to be activated. And you can't activate all those machines with this one. It was one of those downloadable cards. You know, you get that little card. The client went out to Office Max or Best Buy or wherever and bought, you know, a stack of these cards for us. So you can activate once per card is the way it works. So if you're going to, here's where people get messed up though, because, and I know we did this years ago and started rethinking it and called our vendor and said, look, is this the right way? And I said, no, you're doing it the wrong way. So we revamped our technology and our licensing, and we changed it. But what we did was we loaded Microsoft Office on a server, and we were giving people access to that server to open those applications. It's pretty easy to do. You can actually just, you know, have them remote desktop in. You can do shortcuts on their computer that goes to the map drive for where the office is located, put some run times on their computers, and it works. But what we found out is we have to buy a license for each computer that's accessing that software, because Microsoft don't want you to undermine their pricing scheme, right? They don't want you to undermine their livelihood. And if that was the case, you'd be putting a ton of people out of work. I don't think people realize that. As a technologist, you should realize that. There's people out there writing this software. It's not free. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart, you know, to bless your network with free software. There's a lot of free applications out there that work just as well. We recently heard of a whole county, and I'm talking about their county courthouse, their county police officers, the county sheriff, the county deeds, the will of trust, all those people. What they did, they changed over to LibreOffice, and they did that. Some companies are changing over to Google Apps. I told you in the past, that's what our organization is using now for 90%, well, not 90, maybe 75% of the people are now using Google Docs and find it to be just enough of what they need. Because to be honest with you, if you're buying, and not, again, nothing against Microsoft Office. Everybody thinks Jack's a Microsoft Office hater, and I'm not. I'm a computer realist. I think that's the word. But I believe in real-world applications. I believe in real-world usage, and I believe in real-world usage of the software. And when you spend all that money for Microsoft Office, I don't know. It's like if you buy a motorboat because you can afford a motorboat, but you live in the middle of the desert and there's no water. So you're paying for a lot of stuff that you're never going to use, is what I'm saying. And a lot of these places are starting to figure this out. Again, I'm not a Microsoft hater, but Microsoft is in it to make money. So if you're a Microsoft lover, and I do love the guys at Microsoft, don't get me wrong. Especially I had some, personal dealing with them with that interview. I think it's a great, great organization. And I've told everybody in my lifetime, Bill Gates has made me a lot of money, not because I have stocks, because of the sweat of my brow, the pain in my hands from hooking servers together and working on workstations. Microsoft has made me a ton of money. If you're into client stuff, if you're working as a consultant, think how many Microsoft Windows computers you clean on a weekly basis. So Microsoft is making you money. So bless it that they're there. We do enjoy them being there. I think it's a very important entity. And face it, computing wouldn't be computing if they weren't there. So, but they need paid. So if you're going to use their software and you're going to embrace Microsoft Office in your organization, that's fine because a lot of colleges are still using it. And they're still, that's kind of when you graduate college, people think that's all I know is Microsoft Office. No, you know how to click icons. You know how to change fonts. You know how to change text size. You know how to strike and underline and attach files. And you know how to put graphics in. All these applications I talked about tonight, LibreOffice, Google Docs, they all do that. So if you can do that, you can click around and figure your way through any program. Don't ever lock yourself into, I only know Microsoft Word. No, that's not true. You only want to know Microsoft Word, right? That's what you want to know. So that would be like me saying, and believe me, folks, sometimes, I got a case of the ooh, but when I went out to buy my first Mac computer, when I went to the Apple store, because there was a lot of Mac hype, and I said, wow, I really want to buy a Mac, and I do a lot of photography stuff. A lot of you might know that I do photography and I do a lot of YouTube videos on photography, is that I wanted the 27-inch iMac. And when I went out there, I had so many questions for the guy. I said, how do you install applications? How do I drag stuff to that toolbar on the bottom, that taskbar? How do I uninstall applications? I mean, I didn't know anything about it, right? So that is very critical with the computer. And Windows is the same thing. But if Windows wasn't around, nobody'd be using computers, I don't think. Because back in the DOS days, it wasn't too much fun when you had to write a text editor to type a letter. It wasn't a whole lot of fun. Anyway, we're getting a little bit off track here, as I always do. So applications, client access licenses, make sure you have enough of those. Another issue that can complicate licensing is that virtualized environments tend to be highly dynamic. A guest operating system might be created on one host server and then immediately migrated to a different host. Similarly, new VMs can be created on a whim by anyone who has the required permission. So how can the administrator keep up with licensing requirements? Man, is that hits it nail on the head, because we did that recently, right? I told you, we just brought up two new Windows 2012 servers. And we brought those up, and they both are now activated. But when we brought those up, I called our vendor, and I said, look, we need to buy licensing for this. Can you get the licensing certified? Can you send us our key codes, which they did? So we got those environments activated. But you can. You can bring up a VM in a second. We even have some VMs that we have downed just in case we need them. It's funny because I remember years ago arguing with a software vendor because they came and said, our software needs its own server. And I said, you're out of your mind. Your software needs its own server because you don't want to take a chance of it conflicting with anything else that we may have on it. Why don't you tell me the truth? I hate when software vendors, or any vendor at that point, which recently happened to me, lie to me. Don't lie to me. Don't pull my ropes. I've been doing this for too long. I wrote software and sold it. So the same thing, I would tell people, my software needs to have its own server. And in the past, we never did that. In the past, we had a physical box. We had all the software put on there, all of our company applications put on there. And everybody accessed it, or we, you know, at least their files are on there. So they accessed their files. But we've never had an instance where one software was conflicting with another software. It doesn't ordinarily happen. Okay, if they have a shared DLL, maybe an outside chance of that happening, but ordinarily it just doesn't happen. But in today's virtualization world, that doesn't matter anymore, because I could bring up a VM POW, there it is, and we have a couple virtual servers, maybe three of them, with only the vendor software running on it. And why did I do that now? It's for my benefit, not for theirs. I really don't care about their software. I don't care about their policies. I don't care about what they believe is a good idea, right? Because it's my network. I build it and it's mine. Here's why I do it. I use the VMs with their software on because if I get to down their software, if I could update their software and reboot a server, it doesn't affect any of my other applications. It doesn't affect any of my other servers. That's why I do it. It's for my benefit, not for theirs. So get that through your head. Here you go. Every software vendor has its own unique licensing requirements. So it is critically important to make sure that you adhere to the requirements for the software that you're using rather than following a general set of guidelines. Even so, there are some general strategies that generally work. I think we're going to go over a couple of these. But so what they're saying is software vendors out there, there is some software vendors out there that require different licensing. I tend to buy software that is what's called now, if you work for schools, universities, or whatnot, you want to buy what's called campus licensing. So you can put on anything in your campus, anywhere, anytime, it's up to you. That's what you'd like to buy. If it's a little bit restrictive, buy at least server-based licensing. So you can pull in a server and you can have as many clients accessing that software as you wish, because you don't know how many clients you're bringing online. Now, if you're a small business, if you're a business with 5 people, maybe 10 people, maybe even 15, it may be beneficial and cost effective for you to buy it per client. So you ask the vendor, how much is it per, if you talk district or campus, if you're in a school system. If you're in an organization, you might say, how much is it based on the organization license or client license, and kind of work it out and weigh it out in your benefit. Again, don't benefit the software vendor. That's not why they're there. They're there. You're the buyer. The buyer always has their upper hand. And I could do a whole show talking about you about buying and people selling you, because I deal with it every single day of the week. People trying to sell me stuff, people trying to roll me through the mud, people trying to pull me through the dirt, and then I call them on and they're like, oh crap, like their pants were down the whole time I was talking to them, like, oh no, we didn't know we were doing it, Jack, we're so sorry. Yeah, you did. You were just trying to get us to miss it, and we don't miss money leaving the organization. And if you're in a for-profit business, well, I hope that you feel the same way. If you're the tech person there, don't let your money slip through the cracks, okay? Big software vendors, especially if you're doing backup, if you're doing the one that gets me is these damn maintenance fees with software. I get so tired of maintenance. And if there's not going to be something beneficial in it for me and my company, then I don't buy it. The software. I don't buy the software assurance packages. That's bull crap. That's no more than like an extended benefit on a brand new refrigerator. Do you want the 3 years extended warranty? You don't think this refrigerator is going to last 3 years and you're selling me a piece of junk? No. Don't do that. Because most times with software vendors, and I'm not picking on if you're writing software, bless you, because I wrote software for a long time and it's very tedious and it takes a lot of time and effort. But the truth of it is, you know, I would rather pay a software vendor if all you're giving me is, oh, Jack, you know, you pay us $1,500 a year and you can call us anytime you need us. Normally, I don't need you. Okay. That's the big thing. So what I do is ask them, do you have a per call a charge? Oh yeah, Jack, we charge $100 per hour. So it might be better to do it on the basis of when you need them instead of paying $1,500 a year in case you need them, because you're probably not. Now with that, the $1,500, I'm getting a little bit off base here, but the $1,500, if you pay that, here's what you ask them. Do I get free upgrades for the life of the software as long as my maintenance agreement is paid for? If they say no, scrap them. Throw them out of your organization and get rid of them people right away because they're doing nothing but sucking the life out of your company. What you want to do is hear yes. So if I pay $500, $1,000 a year, if I find out there's an upgrade first, you better email me and tell me there's an upgrade. Don't try to send it out there and not let me know because I'll figure it out. Two, make sure I get the upgrade. I receive a free download and I can upgrade my software and I get the phone support for the year. Then I buy the yearly maintenance contract that it's worth it. And we have quite a few vendors that we deal with that work on that basis. So it's something you have to think about. Now, let's see here real quick. My first recommendation is to pay attention to any socket-specific license requirements. It is common for hypervisor vendors, remember we talked about this a little bit ago, to base their licensing requirements for hypervisors for the management server on the number of CPU sockets used within the host server. So we just talked about that. Another bit of advice is that the licensing requirement for applications do not usually change just because the application is running on a virtual server rather than a physical one. We talked about that. Of course, the agreement could be made that most application vendors probably assume their products are running on a virtual server. I guess in today's world, that is true. In most cases, you will probably find that there's nothing abnormal about licensing an application to run on a virtual server. It's the same as if you're running it on a physical server. There's nothing really different about that. Because the server, as far as the software package is concerned, think of that as your physical server. It doesn't matter if you have 9 of those on a box or 1 of those on a box. That is the server. The software is the server. The server is a piece of hardware, okay? A very good piece of hardware, but it's a piece of hardware. Just as most applications have the same licensing requirements for both physical and virtual environments, server client access licenses usually work the same way in a virtual environment as they do in a physical data center. If an operating system vendor requires a license for every user who accesses the server, that requirement doesn't usually go away just because the server is running on a virtualized hardware. On a side note, some OS vendors give their customers a choice of purchasing client access licenses on either a per-user or a per-device basis. We talked about that a few weeks ago. Historically, per-device licensing has been the least expensive option. However, users today commonly make use of multiple devices, so you may find per-user licensing is more cost-effective. Think about that for a minute. That is a really extremely good topic. Because in today's modern world, we found that every user usually has 3 devices. They usually have their phone they're going to put on your wireless if you're a technology administrator like myself, and you give free access to your wireless access in your network. And if you're not, you probably should rethink of what you're doing in your life and maybe change job titles and go somewhere else and do something else, like sell shoes at a Barnes and JCPenney's or something, because you're not probably in the right profession. This is why I say that, folks. If you hire somebody for your business, if your business hires somebody, you don't, you're the technology person. Your company hires somebody to work for the company. It is the damnedest thing I ever heard in my life that you would restrict them from things such as the internet. Well, unless you have company policy, give them internet access on their phones, right? Give them the Wi-Fi passcodes. Let them bring their tablets in and put it on your network. Let them bring their own personal laptops if they want to. Who gives the biggest crap? Okay, make sure they have the virus software and all the hip hype hoodah on there, you know, to make sure your network is safe. But you know what? If your servers aren't protected, well, then, again, you're probably damned anyway. And I'm sorry I'm on these soapboxes, but this is the stuff that gets me going with technology directors, and I hear these nightmares out there from people, folks. I hear people say, man, Jack, I work at a company. They won't even give us the Wi-Fi password for our phone. We got to use our LGE or our LTE data all day, our 3G data. That's just wrong. You hired these people. You entrusted these people to do things such as either educate, such as run your companies, take care of your medical assets, whatever it is, give them the damn Wi-Fi password. All right? That's very, very important. Here's why I'm getting to this topic, though. license your servers on a per user base, because every user may have three devices. So if you do it on per device, we're talking about 10 employees and 10 desktops. We're talking about 10 employees with possibly 30 devices. It's cheaper to pay for the 10 employees than it is the 30 devices. So look at your network and damn it, get off your high horse and give these people some wireless access. It's very, very important. You will find in your networks, and I can do another topic about this sometime, but you will find in your networks that if you allow people to use their consumer electronics, and I agree it's consumer stuff, and we've argued with this with, I've argued with Apple, I've argued with Microsoft with tablets, I've argued with Toshiba, I've argued with people with Android tablets. Damn it, put away, we can put a server password username on it so they can at least log into their account so we know who they are. But it doesn't work that way. So you can have a guest wireless access on your network. It takes you 10 minutes to set it up. You know, put the cheese puffs down. You don't need to eat the cheese puffs. Quit drinking all the Coke and all the Mountain Dew. Quit playing, Minecraft on the computer. And take a minute and set up a guest access network on your wireless controller. Allow those people to just get on your wireless and go to the internet. They're not going to interfere with their servers. They're not going to steal any of your data. Everybody's happy. They're happy. You are a king in your field, because right now you may not be. Right now you might be looked down upon. We as technologists want to be looked up upon. That's just the way we do it. Now, unless your VMs are running free, which we just talked about, free open source OS or Ghost or Guest OS, or on your VMs, they must be licensed. Guest OS licensing policies vary widely, so it's extremely important to check with a vendor to determine a specific requirement. In the case of Windows Server 2012 R2, the server license applies to the host, not to the VM. This host-level license applies to the VMs running on the host. This holds true regardless of which vendor's hypervisor is being used. So they're not saying, hey, if you use a Microsoft hypervisor, you got to license each server. Nope, any virtualization software out there, any of it has to be, each instance has to be licensed. Now, let's talk just a little bit about hypervisor costs. The hypervisor pricing and licensing, a comparison, takes a look at the cost of licensing policies of VMware, Microsoft, and Citrix. Let's not forget Citrix Systems. I usually forget them because they are the highest priced organization in the world. I don't know how they get away with it because their software is no better than anybody else's out there. And if you want to argue with me, we can call in on Skype and we'll fight about it. And the only reason you're going to fight about it is your company has billions of dollars and my company does not. You can afford to buy it. I can't. You drive a Rolls Royce. I drive a Volkswagen. They both get us to the same place at the same time. But I'm usually a little bit more concerned about money than you may be. But Citrix is not where it used to be. Citrix used to sit on the hill and they were untouchable. VMware and Microsoft is coming to knock you off the hill, so get ready for it. Now, VMware, vSphere, Microsoft Hyper-V, Citrix Zen Server don't just have different features and capabilities, they are priced and licensed differently too. Oh my, that's a true one. For instance, some virtualization offerings are priced per processor, others per server, and still some others are, believe it or not, free. We talked about that. ESXi is free. With important caveats surrounding management capabilities, feature sets, and server size. Support also differs on platform to platform. For some, support is purchased annually. We talked about that. For others, per incident. We talked about that. And hypervisor license policies and price structure can also have a profound effect on what? Your IT organization's budget and operations. And this must be examined as closely as technical features and functionality. Now, wow, that was a mouthful, right? Let's go over that for a minute. Here's what happens in the world of technology, business, and I've talked to a lot of business owners out there. I was a business owner for years. And this is kind of what happens. The technical department in your organization, the CIO, I know it's one's a CIO, Chief Information Officer, Chief Systems Officer, CTO, Chief Technical Officer. these people that make these budgets and make these decisions and make these plans to build this stuff can actually put you, the network administrator, the hardware support analyst, the data analyst, the network administrator, can put you out of a job. And I tell you how they do this. This is very, it's ludicrous that this happens. Sometimes we can build the biggest dream in the world, and that big dream can cost us $1.5 million per year for our budgeting. Because when we're building a network, when we're building a dream server, when we're building a dream switching unit, when we're building all this great stuff, there's this little hidden cost in there that we got to manage year to year that a lot of people forget about. And I keep track of these just in Excel spreadsheets, because I don't have a lot. Some companies may have so many, you might need some kind of database. But what these hidden costs are called is management and maintenance cost. And we talked about this a little bit ago about software. Well, folks, hardware has it too. And for years, Cisco, my beloved Cisco, and I think they're a wonderful company. And yeah, you can argue HP's this and some other great switching companies out there. And there's thousands of them, and they are all great. They work really well. I know Cisco because I've been programming Cisco for so many years, and I kind of got the idea of Cisco down. So I say my beloved Cisco. But, you know, they almost lost me as a customer because they had that unbelievably high-priced maintenance thing they were doing. And I can't remember the name they used, that Energizer, not Energizer updates, but they had this weird name for it. And, you know, and when HP is selling you a switch, a managed layer 2 or layer 3 switch, and they're giving you free overnight replacement for the life of that switch, Cisco better get a little bit of, you know, now I believe Cisco and Citrix at one point was probably like one company. I think they split. And really, I'm not trying to hype on Citrix at all. I think Citrix is a wonderful company. It's a very good software. But so Cisco finally came off this. They said, look, now they're kind of doing things a little bit differently. They're kind of giving you, you know, better maintenance contracts on their stuff. But remember, when you're writing your budget, you got to write this in. So what happens over time is, as these CIOs, CSOs and CTOs and COOs and whatever, as they're sitting down writing these budgets and building all these great networks, they're forgetting about this back-end thing called the maintenance contracts. So the maintenance contracts are building. Every time you add a switch, you have a new maintenance contract, another server, another maintenance contract, another piece of software, another maintenance contract. So in 5 years' time, you just lost two employees because then your company says, wait, you got to pay all this stuff. We don't have enough to pay Joe and Bob, you know, the service techs downstairs that handle the phone support. We just can't pay them no more. You know, they're $12,000 a year is killing us. That's $24,000 a year. Okay, they're both permanently laid off and they'll never be called back because some guy at the top didn't think enough ahead. So when you're planning your budgets, when you're buying your stuff, keep your stuff in a spreadsheet and plan your maintenance costs out for, you know, 10 years, 15 years. At least plan it out until you retire. So that way, if something happens after you retire, you're not really responsible for it anymore, right? It's off your plate. But when you're there, you don't want all your crew to be gone and you're left by yourself. That just doesn't work out well either. So hopefully you understand tonight's topic of hypervisor and VMware licensing as far as you know, the overall software licensing goes. And you got a better idea of licensing concerns when you're virtualizing. It's just a huge topic, and like I said, we can probably talk about this for, you know, a few more weeks, but I'm not going to pull your ear over a few more weeks. But it's just a very, very large topic. Now, what I will tell you wrapping up tonight's show is, by all means, contact your software vendors. Make sure you understand what you're paying for. If you're paying maintenance contracts on your software or your hardware, make sure you know the replacements of this stuff. I had one hardware vendor one time. They guaranteed me when they sold it to me an overnight replacement, and they lied their backsides off, and it upset me so bad. They were gone. We had a breakdown of their equipment. It happened to be a critical piece of hardware that I needed to run in my network, and it broke down. I called them. They said, oh, yeah, Jack, why don't you ship it back? When we receive it, we'll pack up a new one and send it out to you. I said, whoa, that wasn't what you said. You told me it would free over, you know, most companies that we have now, we have a company, they will send us a new one in that box. They send us a new one, and we put it in, and we put the old one in the box, in their box, and they pay to ship it back. Now, that is a quality company. That's who you want to deal with. So be very careful. You know what you're paying for. If you're paying software assurances or whatever, or software maintenance costs, make sure all your updates do come for free, because that's huge. You don't want to be paying $1,500 a year and an update comes out and you go, oh, yeah, that's $5,000. You're like, yeah, kiss my backside. You know what I mean? You got to be very up straight and very front with these software vendors and hardware vendors. It's your job, especially if you're sitting at the head of the table and you're making the decisions to pull them cords and get them checks written. It's your job to help manage your company's money and spend it wisely on technology, not just wholeheartedly and just blowing the money around. Again, go get yourself a job selling shoes at JCPenney's or, you know, wherever, Walmart or wherever you sell the finer shoes at, and get out of this business, because you're not doing a good job. This podcast is meant to help you do your job to your fullest, and it lets me blow some steam and talk to you guys in a fun way. You know, I think we have a good time with this podcast. So hopefully you'll join me next week here for another session. Folks, please remember to use my Amazon link. I opened the show tonight saying I made a whopping $47 this month, and thank you so much. And I'm not saying that in a condescending or bad way. I've never received a check from Amazon. I was blown away to see a direct deposit in my bank. It's like, wow, Amazon. And you guys did it out there, you people using my link. So keep using that link. I think somebody on there actually bought underwear or something. I don't know. But buy whatever. I don't know who you are buying. It just shows me like what people bought. It doesn't tell me who bought what. So don't think I'm spying on you by any means, but it just says like what people bought, and the percentage I get was like 12 cents. But all those 12 cents is add up, and it helps pay things like the microphone cost here. I mean, the microphones, mixers, all this stuff, you know, that we use to put a podcast together, hosting fees. It's all because of you, and you guys are kind of paying it forward to me by using that Amazon link. So go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Make sure you deactivate your ad blocker, tech people, and you'll see the link on there. Use that link and use my Amazon link when you buy anything. And folks, if you want to learn about Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012 R2, or VMware ESXi 5.5 point, whatever it is, 2, from install to administration, folks, you're going to learn it all. Sign up for one of my online courses at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Look at the online class link at the top of the page. Click on that. The courses are self-paced, folks. Just watch a simple video and you're on your road to success, right? Once you complete the course, I will send your certificate in the mail. Those things are good for framing. They're good for getting jobs. They're good for putting with your resume. They're excellent for sending with your resume, so people know that, hey, I am still learning this stuff every day. I want to be fresh for your company. When you hire me to make that $150,000 a year, I want to be ready to go. Or when you want to hire me to make that, you know, $40,000 a year. But with this training, folks, you're not going to be qualified to work in that call center making $12,000 a year that those two people in my story got laid off earlier. It won't be you, because you'll be a network administrator. You'll be higher on the pay grade, and that's where you want to be. So take one of these courses, sign up today at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Very low priced, very inexpensive, and it's my way of paying it forward to giving you the knowledge you need to advance your careers to the place you want to be. So check those courses out. I'm sure you'll enjoy those. And have a great work week, if that's at all possible. The weather here on the East Coast is starting to break, so that's a benefit. We're looking at this Saturday. They're telling us it's going to be about 45 degrees. And when you're coming out of the negative 12s and the negative 8s, 45 is a blessing to all of us. I can't wait for the warmer weather. And join me here next week for another show on Tuesday night. I record these things Tuesday night at 8 p.m. I don't record them live, so obviously you can't see me or join me. But, you know, you can enjoy it right after I post it, and you can enjoy it Wednesday on the way to work. I mean, yeah, Wednesday on the way to work, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whatever. Spread the word. Tell everybody about this show, tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Take care, my friends. I'll talk to you next week. Bye for now. You just listened to Tips from the Server Room with your host, Jack. If you have any questions, please drop me a comment at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Thanks again for tuning in and downloading the shows. Now sit back, relax, and listen to the remainder of the music. We'll see you next week on Tips from the Server Room. So long.